Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the September 4th meeting of Freedom Forum of Orange County. I thank you for being here tonight. Our speaker for this evening is Bill Thornton, who will be presenting to us how to operate with court procedures. And this should be a very interesting topic, especially when some of our audience have had to experience that during their time here. Bill has been working with various programs. He's taught classes on what to do as far as court procedure concerned. He's also taught about how to handle situations pertaining to legal issues that most of us take for granted rather than knowing and understanding the things that are going on. And Bill, along with that, he has his own site, 1215.org, where those of you who have not been to it yet have an opportunity to find out and get some education, because it's not just a matter of local information, but it's also a site that helps to teach each of us some of the tools that we can use to deal with certain issues. And most of us probably have certain issues that we would like to be able to deal with, and a lot of times we don't know the answers. And instead of paying a high price to talk to somebody who may or may not really be telling you what you need to do, this is one tool that most of us who want to know more about a given subject can go to and be able to use that to prepare themselves for whatever their particular event's going to be. One of the things we have, for those of you that have not been here or picked up some of the things, some of the videos from our previous meetings. This one, Bill, spoke on challenging jurisdiction with habeas corpus. And his site, he also calls it the Nitty Gritty Law Library. And it is nitty and it is gritty. But he's been doing this, the library, for over 40 years, and so there's a lot of information there that most of us, through experience and through his experience, will benefit us. So, are you now available? Okay, at this time, let's welcome Bill Thornton to speak to us on
procedure.
Court procedures. Thank you.
Okay.
Bill?
Thank you. Okay, well, court procedure. It's hard to talk about court procedure without also talking about theory, but I'm going to try and keep the theory to a minimum. All the theories on the website, 1215.org. So, hopefully you can go to that. I did make a major change to the website. When you go to a website, normally you put in the name, www something, whatever. If you put in http and then a colon // and then the website name, that is the formal format that you use to access it. If you put in the same thing but you add one more letter, https and then a colon //, that gives you a secure communication that cannot be tapped into. The government has been concerned because more and more websites are going dark. In their language, that means that they don't know what you're looking at. So when you do your web surfing, my website is now set up. You can access the same information either secured or unsecured, either way. Okay? I suggest you use the S. Once you get into the S, it'll stay in the S. You can go around, click on different things. It'll go to secured websites. Yes?
Okay, HTTPS://
Well, you don't have to put the W's in. That's optional. But some people love W's, so, you know, it's okay. It's an option.
Slash
W. Sure. Yeah, it's an option. You can put the W's or not on my website. HTTP as in Paul, S as in Sam, :// and then the website, whatever it may be. Yeah, they can't monitor it in, like, you know, the same way. They call it going dark. More and more websites are going dark.
So the S and the :// at the end?
The S is what makes it secure. If you leave the S out, you still get access.
But it's not secure.
But it's not secured, right. This security is an interesting thing. That,
that is interesting.
The guy that put it all together, his name was Zimmerman, coincidentally.
Really?
And Zimmerman, when he came up with this program back in the 1980s, I think it was called Pretty Good Privacy, PGP. And it had a security method that was, for all practical purposes, impossible to break. Just impossible. Because the concept is that if I make up a password to secure something, some information, and there's a password, it's only secure as long as I'm the only one who knows the password. But as soon as I give someone else the password, not only does that person know it, which is fine, but what if it got intercepted and somebody else now has it? So there was a mathematical technique that was invented many years ago, and it was too cumbersome to do manually. But when computers came along, it became pretty easy. And what it is this. You make up two passwords. You have one password for encrypting. You have the other password for decrypting. Okay? So, I make up two passwords. I give one to the other one, and I don't care who knows what that password is, because that password is to encrypt. And even if you know the password that was used for encrypting, you can't use it to reverse engineer and find out what the message is. And I'm the only one who knows the decrypting password. So that's how this system works. When you log on to a website that is secure, that website sends the encryption password to you, and then whatever you send gets encrypted, and it has the password for decrypting, and that computer on the other end is the only one that knows. So it's really a good system. Anyhow, what we want to talk about is procedure. So on the website at 1215.org, you click on Start Here or the Red Pill. Anybody ever tried clicking on the blue pill? Takes you to the White House website. Okay. So I just clicked on the blue pill. Okay. Well, anyway, you can click on the red pill or start here. And this takes you to the theory. This gives you a lot of theory about, you know, the basis which you can find out when you go there. And then after you learn the theory, follow the instructions carefully. A lot of people like to skip around, and of course that works against them because the knowledge is built serially so that if you start at the beginning and you build on the knowledge, you get an understanding of what it is. But if you try to skip around and just look at stuff that's interesting, you will miss some very important information. But once you go through that, you follow those instructions and learn it, then you go to the next page in the lower right-hand corner. Okay? And it says to next page. And then on the left side of this page, you have more links. And one of the links that's there is called procedure. Okay? So we click on procedure. And we have a bunch of stuff. But let's go down to common law pleading papers. Okay? I think I'm at the right place here. I hope I am. Okay, if it's not, we'll go back. An action at law. Here are the basically this goes into the details of a common law action, which we can get into, but I want the overall procedure. So I think this is it here. This is it. Okay? Now basically when you are a defendant, the only thing I can tell you is you don't want to be the defendant. Okay? The defendant has no power. Now, to really understand this, you have to understand that you want to be the plaintiff, because the plaintiff is the king or queen. The plaintiff lives in the plaintiff's castle, and anyone who comes into the castle is subject to the plaintiff's castle rules, or you might call it the law of the domicile, as it's technically known. So if you're in your castle and you see the neighboring sovereign coming across the field with his army, you don't just sit there and try to talk him out of it. What you do is you gather up your troops and you go out there and you meet him in the field. That's called a counterclaim. Okay? He's got his claim against you. You put your claim in against him. Okay? And in football they say that the best defense is a good offense. And that is true of law. You've got to be on the offensive. If you're a defendant, your position within the court is that of a subject of the king. Okay? Or a subject of the queen. So you don't want to be a subject. Yes, sir.
If you're a defendant, can't you just request a jury trial? That way the plaintiff...
Of course you can.
...the jury agree with him before...
You definitely can... If you're a defendant, you definitely can request a jury trial. But guess what? You're still a defendant. Okay? You're still in his castle. And it is the king who selects the jury. Okay? That's a centuries-old custom. The court selects the jury, not the individuals. In fact, there's case law which says that if neither the plaintiff nor the judge nor the defendant examine the jury, then the jury cannot be examined. Okay? That jury is there because the king put them there. Now, maybe I ought to explain this jury thing a little better. You see, if you're talking about a common law court, a real law court that has real law, then you are entitled to a jury. And the jury will make the decision. And to understand the part of the jury, think of it this way. Put your mind back in the 15th century. The year is 1450, okay? Or whatever. And you are a sovereign nobleman, and another nobleman comes over and wants your territory, wants your castle. Well, your choice is to go ahead and duke it out with him on the field, his army against your army. The problem is that situation can be a little unpredictable. You might lose. So they got this neat little system where the nobleman who is being attacked, that's the defendant, he calls on 12 other noblemen, and those 12 other noblemen show up with their 12 armies, and they take charge. And so they listen to your case. and they make a decision. And whatever decision they made, it's now 13 armies against one army. Well, that brought peace to the realm, okay? So that's what your jury really is. Now, the jury has earned a lot of respect, partly because of the Reverend William Penn, the same guy after whom Pennsylvania is named, when he had a jury decision that recognized his freedom to worship as he wished, despite the fact that the king put a lock on the door of his church in England. So the jury became very well respected as a result of that case. But that's what the jury is. But this is only in a court of law. Now you have the other kind of court, which is the court in equity. And the court of equity only exists for a particular reason, and that is this. You have this, what do they call this? What's the name of that group that attacked Rome and did them in? The Vandals, I guess it was, and there was another group too. Well, that was a specific tribe, but and a specific leader. Anyway, there was this group that did in Rome, and when they conquered Rome, they were in charge, but there weren't enough of them to control Rome. So what they did is they hired a lot of the personnel that Rome already had, including them on the staff. So you had the coming together of three kinds of law. You had Rome had already conquered Great Britain, so you had the common law of Britain, which had infiltrated into Rome. You had the Roman civil law, which had come in, and then you had this other law that came in, and their philosophy is that the king was king by divine right. He was the representative of God. And so by divine right, he was the source of the law. So you had the English system, which basically said that the people were the source of the law. You had this other system where the king was the source of the law, and then you had the in-between system, which is the Roman civil law system. So our system in America, which was inherited from that, is actually kind of a combination of all three. However, the bias is in the side of the people, because the Constitution starts off right in the preamble, and it says, "We the people ordained and created this Constitution for the United States of America." So that puts the people on top. When we say we ordained it, that means we're the authority that granted or delegated authority. We are the authority, and when we created it, that means we actually put it on the parchment. We wrote it. So we ordained and created this Constitution for whom? Not for us. The preamble says it was for the United States of America. And if you look at the state constitutions, a lot of them basically mimic that wording. They say, "We the people created," or "We the people ordained," something like that. And so the state is a creature of the people. So the people are above the state. They're outside the Constitution. The Constitution is specifically written for the government. So so the people are the source of the law. And you look at the Constitution for that. So now, when the people do a lawsuit, well, kind of backing up a little bit, the Supreme Court itself has recognized that what they said was that the decree of the sovereign is what makes law. Well, now, if the people are sovereign, and if they decree something, that is the law, the real law. Okay? Now let's go back to this concept of equity courts versus law courts. So in the law courts, under the system that was brought in the law courts, they tend, when you let the power structure be in charge, they tend to want to work things in their favor. So they like the concept that the law comes from the king and not from the people. However, we have a few details, such as the Magna Carta and the U.S. Constitution, which basically subscribes to the Lockean theory of law, which is that the law comes from the people. So, but the way it worked, when you have the power from the top concept, is you have this law court, and the law is now defined. And so when you have a case, you go to the law court because you want remedy based on the law. But what if there's no law to cover your situation? Well, then the next thing you do is you go over to the king, the source of the law, and you say, King, I need a law right now to get my remedy. And the king says, I'm too busy. Okay? He says, so instead of me making a law on the spot, I want you to go to my chancellor. You couldn't go anywhere in the law court with my judges because there was no law for them to enforce. So go over to my chancellor, who is my right-hand man, and I have granted to my chancellor all of the same powers that I have, subject only to my review. Okay? Because the king can override the chancellor. So you go to the chancellor, and you have this writ in hand, which authorizes the chancellor to hear your case. And by the way, the writs are no longer issued. It's just assumed, all right? But you go over to the equity court, and now the chancellor sits there, and he considers what you have to say, and he makes up a law on the spot. Now, do you understand that he has the power of the king? The power to make law, the power to suspend law, and the power to enforce the law. But we're not talking about real law. We're talking about equity law. What is equity law? Equity law consists of statutes, codes, and past decisions. Okay? That's equity law. All of that's equity. Because it's not the law of the people. It's the law of the king. Okay? In a sense, the people. It's not their law. It's law made up by representatives. So it's all equity. So it's a real, when you go to an equity court, it's a real loose deal. And sure, not realizing this, you'll go to court and you'll bring in case law, which says that if the case is similar to my existing case, therefore you expect a certain decision. But the person who really decides all this is the judge. Only in that capacity, he's not really a judge. He's actually a chancellor. We call him judge because in the United States, we took the two court systems and merged them together procedurally. And so although constitutionally they are separated, in actual practice, it's the same guy. The judge is the chancellor and the chancellor is the judge. So, well, whatever doctrine. I mean, the point is they were merged together. And if you read the codes carefully, you might just find some codes that conflict with each other because one of them is actually equity and the other is actually law. Okay? That's happened. I think I found that in Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule Number 7. I forget which was which. There's an A, B, and C, and there was one that sort of conflicted with the other, and that was why they conflicted, because they were actually two different sources of authority. Anyhow, so the equity court, the judge has total authority. Now, because the concept of a jury is so strong, they decided as a matter of policy only, get that, only policy, that they will allow you to have a jury trial in the equity court. But and if you understand, in equity court, the chancellor has complete authority to suspend the rules, to create new rules, or to enforce existing rules. It's his discretion. So when you're in equity court and you get a decision you don't like, you can appeal it. And 99% of the appeals are lost on the simple basis that, well, you gave the chancellor permission to use his discretion. Why should you complain if he used it? Make sense? You know, gave him permission. So if the judge varies too much according to the tastes of the appellate judges, well, yeah, they might correct him. You know, if he offends their conscience or something like that. Some judge once said that everyone is presumed to know the law except His Majesty's judges, who have the Court of Appeals to set him right. Okay. So, but this is the job of the equity court. So you can't complain when you get a bad decision out of an appellate court unless the decision is so bad it offends the conscience of the appellate court judges. Okay? That's why I like a court of record. A court of record is real law. In a court of record, you're the plaintiff. Assuming you're the plaintiff, you own the court. You decree what the law is. Whenever I write an action at law, I have two things in there that make my case different from a normal equity case. The first thing I have is right in the very first sentence. In fact, I'll bring it up. Let's see. We will bring it up right now. I went to 1215.org/Q. Okay. And here is the counterclaim. Okay. They sued first, and here the plaintiff sued back. Counterplaintiff. All right. And look what this first sentence says in the case. Paragraph 1. Was that? Oh, I see. Sure. Okay, let's get this big enough so you can read it.
Bill, those two courts are equity court and what's the other one?
Law court. Whenever you see the word law and it's not qualified, it means a common law court. Okay, whenever you see the word equity, that means it's an equity court. Whenever you see the word equity law, that means an equity court. It's not real law. But they put that law thing in there to confuse you. Okay, now notice how this sentence starts off. Aurora Bautista Quicho, here in Aurora, is one of the people of California and in this court of record complains of each of the following. And then it names all the defendants. And it names the defendants by their names. It doesn't say what they are. We don't say that he was an officer or that he was a cop or that he was a president, or any, we just simply use their name, okay? And here we name also the state of California. We're not naming the state of California. We're assuming in this lawsuit that the state of California is a name being used by a human somewhere, okay? Because we don't know. Could be a human. All we know is that somebody came in and said, state of California sent me. Well, we know if it's an inanimate object, you can't talk too well, so it must have been a human. Okay? However, even though they may not be a human, but actually an artificial entity, it can still be liable to you in a court of record. See? You still collect from it. So, but look what we did with this little innocuous, simple statement. First of all, the counter plaintiff identified herself. This is her name. And then she says she's one of the people of California. Well, we're using constitutional language here. California preamble says that the people created the state. Okay, not in those words, but that's basically what it says. Okay, so when you say you're one of the people of the jurisdiction, that means you're the sovereign relative to that jurisdiction. You're the king or queen. Okay? So you establish your sovereignty. You don't say you're sovereign. It's implied in the words. Okay? And you'll enforce it later. If they disrespect that, you can enforce it later. But in the beginning, you see, they're demonizing the word sovereign. They're demonizing word citizen even. They're doing a lot of demonizing. So I don't make those claims. When I write a lawsuit, I just use basic constitutional wording. Now, the term sovereignty is not missed here, because later on elsewhere, which I'll explain in a moment, but elsewhere in the lawsuit, I claim that the people are sovereign, and I quote directly out of the codes. Okay? There is a code, I think it's a government code, section 100, that says the sovereignty of the state is in the people. Okay? So, if you're one of the people, you must be sovereign, right? But I never, ever allow the word sovereign to be next to my name in the same sentence. Okay? That's how I avoid the demonization. So, but this little first sentence establishes the sovereignty of the counterplaintiff. Then it says, and in this court of record complains of each of the following. Well, the court of record has a very specific definition. Okay? It has to meet four requirements to be a court of record. Number one, it has to keep a record of the proceedings. Now, what is a record of the proceedings? A record of the proceeding is very simply what was proposed to the court and what did the court decide. That's the record. Everything else is meaningless. Okay? So, that's all it is a record. Equity courts do not keep records. Only courts of law keep records. You'll notice when you get, I hope all of you are familiar with what a docket sheet is. Anybody here is not familiar with a docket sheet? Okay, a docket sheet is the record you get from the clerk showing, it has listed on it what motions were made, what decisions were made, who showed up, who is the judge. It's just a summary of all the cases. When you go to court, you ask for a docket sheet, then you'll get that. I want you to notice that when you go to all these courts throughout the United States, none of them say record. They don't call it a record of proceedings. They give it other names. They call it, they might call it a docket. They might call it register of actions. Thank you. They got a lot of different names, but they don't call it record because it's not a record. The word record is owned by a court of record. Just to kind of clarify that concept, let's say you have a business. Your business is mowing the lawn. Okay, you mow people's lawns. Okay, you got a nice little agricultural business there. So, would you call your customers patients? Right? You contract with somebody to mow their lawn and you say, okay, you're going to call that person your patient? Why not? Okay? You're not doing anything different than a doctor does. You make a deal and you do the service and you get paid. Well, the problem is that the doctors, the whole medical profession, owns the word patient. Okay? That's specifically their word. So, in a like fashion, those people that you mow the lawn for are not your clients. They are customers. The word client is owned by the attorneys. You use the word client, that implies an attorney-client relationship. That means that you are their advisor. That means you make decisions for them. Okay? Whereas if they're your customer, you now have an arm's length relationship. As a customer, you answer their questions, they make the decisions. They take the responsibility. They are not your clients. So don't ever use the word client for your customers unless you are an attorney. Okay? Same thing. Well, in fact, there was a case where a paralegal lady got charged with practicing law without a license. And they had her on the stand. And every time they would refer to her clients, she would correct them immediately and say, no, they weren't clients, they were my customers. And they could never slip that in. She would never admit that she had clients. And so she won the case. Because they were hoping she would use a word which would convict her. If she'd admitted she had clients, she would admit that she was giving them advice, representing them, making decisions for them, and so forth. So don't ever use the word client, okay? When you're talking about a court of record, the court of record owns the word record when you're talking law, okay? Only a court of record keeps records. And the other courts can pick other terms. Unfortunately, the courts seem to encourage sloppy use of the English language. And so you'll hear attorneys referring to the record and so forth. When I'm in court, if I say for the record, I know I have a court of record and I know I'm making the record. Okay? So, for the record, I object. Okay, so by that simple sentence that you see there, you have set up the conditions for owning the court. You now own the court. Okay, you're the plaintiff and so forth. So that's one thing that I do different from what an attorney would do. The rest of the lawsuit looks like just what an attorney could do. Maybe a lot of them would choose not to do it. But it looks very vanilla. I use a style of writing that's similar to what an attorney would use. I don't put in all the Patriot stuff because I already put in the Patriot stuff in the first sentence. I have this theory that if you shoot a horse once and he's dead, you don't have to shoot him a second time. So you've said it all in that first sentence, you see. Now, later on, see if I can find it. Let's see. I'll look for the law of the case. Here's the law of the case. That's the other thing that I do that's different from what attorneys do. Remember that the Supreme Court has recognized, I didn't say they decided, the Supreme Court has recognized that the decree of the sovereign makes law. Okay? So, here's what I do. You know that there's a rule in the courts that say that your lawsuit cannot be more than 15 pages, I think it is. Is that what it is? Something like that. In your pleading, right. When you put in your complaint, they have a rule that says you cannot have more than 15 pages. And I respect that rule. Now, I can change the rules for my court, but as much as possible, I try to make my court and my procedures look like their courts and their procedures. See, when you're in China arguing your case, it's best to speak Chinese. Okay? You argue your case in English, nobody will understand you. So, it's the same thing here. When I'm in the American court system, where I've got the typical judge, the typical attorney, I will try to put in stuff that they would put in if they were doing their job. But I do put in a couple extra things. One of them, as I've already shown you, is that first sentence. The other thing I put in is the decree of the law. Remember, the Supreme Court recognized that the decree of the sovereign makes law. There's an actual case, and I cite the case in these papers on this website. Okay? So the decree of the sovereign makes law, so I decree it. Now, because of the page limitation, since I decree quite a few laws, it's going to take a lot more space. But the rules allow you to have as many pages as you want in your exhibits. Okay? And the double spacing does not have to be done in your exhibits. Okay? So I put the law of the case in an exhibit, and then I incorporate it by reference as though fully stated herein. Okay? So that makes the declaration or the decree of the law part of the complaint. So that's Exhibit G. The rest of the lawsuit is just like you'd expect from an attorney, complete with the prayer or whatever it is, the summary, demand, whatever. Okay? Sure. First cause of action. If you go to 1215.org/Q and you look at the counterclaim, that's where you'll find it. Okay. Now, let's go back and let's look at the law of the case. Okay, and let's I'm not finding what I'm looking for. I want to make this bigger.
Go Control Plus.
All right, we'll try that. Nope, that works for email, but it doesn't work for a word processor. It should be on here, though. See, it's not. Reviewing pane, no. See, I kind of expected it to be. Well, let's see what it says. No, for some reason it's not popping up.
View, isn't it? View.
Yeah, there you go. And we go.
Should be zoom in. Yeah, there we go. Zoom.
There it is. Yeah, there we go. Okay, and we'll go for about 150. How's that? Okay. Now notice what it says there. The law of the case is decreed as follows. Okay? We have a court case that says that the decree of the sovereign makes law. And I've already declared my sovereignty when I said I was one of the people. Actually, this is one of my cases, Aurora's case, but forgive me for talking in the first person. Anyway, so I say the law is decreed as follows, and now you can decree anything you want. However, you have to understand what a court is. Fundamental reason you have a court is to prove to, it's a stage on which you put a show to prove to the rest of the world why it is that the decision of the sovereign is the correct one. Okay? You're putting on an act. And I've gone on the website, I explain why it is you're putting on the act. But suffice it to say right now, it's just a stage on which you put a show. So, if you're going to put a good show on, you have to speak Chinese in the Chinese court, okay? You can't be bringing in other languages. Same thing in the American courts. If you're going to make your point in the American court, you've got to speak in terms that they understand. It doesn't help to say that God's on your side, okay? This is a secular world, so they're not going to pay any attention to non-secular things. So you have to speak the secular language. And that's what we do. And we start right off. The law of the case is decreed as follows. It is the public policy of this state that public agencies exist to aid in the conduct of the people's business. The people of this state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them. That's in the government code, section 11120. Did I say that? No. The government code says it. What is the government code? Well, it's instructions by the government to the employees, telling them what it is. Am I crazy for quoting the government? You know, how can you demonize the government's codes, right? And I can tell you right now, it is the policy, an understood, unwritten policy, that you never criticize the government. You and in politics, you'll see they'll attack each other, but they never say the government's bad. Okay? Nobody criticizes the government. And so, that's me. I don't criticize the government, too. In fact, I use their codes. And I bank on them not criticizing themselves. Okay? And so, I quote a lot of authority. We've got, what is a law? A written law is that which is promulgated in writing and of which a record is in existence. That's in the California Code of Civil Procedure. Okay? The organic law is the constitution of government and is altogether written. Other written laws are denominated statutes. The written law of this state is therefore contained in its constitution and statutes and in the constitution and statutes of the United States. That's in the California Code of Civil Procedure. Guess what? That means you can bring in a federal statute. Okay? Did I say that? Not at all. That's the government that said that. Okay? And so this whole thing, this law of the case, is pretty much just the citing of existing rules that are in my favor. And if I did not decree the law, then it's not law. Okay? By the way, the defendant cannot decree the law. It's not his castle. Okay? You're in my castle now. It's my court. I'm the sovereign. I sit on the throne. Okay? Once you get that picture, you don't say those things when you're in court, but that is your relationship. You are the sovereign of the court. You own the court. It's a court of record because you decreed it to be a court of record right up front. And the judge is, by definition, in a court of record, not authorized to make any decisions whatsoever. Again, I didn't say it, but I'll go through the four requirements for a court of record. I already mentioned the first one, which is it keeps a record of the proceeding. The second requirement is that it has the power to fine or imprison for contempt. The word power does not mean physical power. It means lawful power. Okay? So you may not have the ability to physically grab the person and put them in jail, but you have the lawful authority to direct them to be put in jail by those who carry the guns. Okay? The cops, in other words, the sheriff. Those two requirements that I just mentioned are in Black's Law Dictionary, 5th edition, and later. If you look at Black's Law Dictionary, 4th edition, and earlier, you will find that there are two more requirements. Now, those requirements didn't go away. They just simply dropped them out of the dictionary. You might call it sin by omission, okay? But the other two are this. It's proceeding according to the common law. That's what a court of record is, proceeding according to the common law. But notice this, it's only common law procedure. You can still assert statutes and codes, okay? But the procedure must be a common law procedure. That means that whatever you're claiming, whatever your cause of action, it must fall into one of 11 different common law causes of action. It has to be one of those 11, and I'll show you a little later what those are. But if it's not one of those, you have no case in the common law. Okay? But these 11 are pretty thorough. They pretty well cover it. For example, trespass. That's one of the common law causes of action. What is trespass? Well, trespass is either actual force when you were injured or threat of force. You get stopped by a policeman on the street. He's carrying a gun. Do you feel threatened? Then you have a common law cause of action called, what did I say? Trespass. Yeah. Senior moment. So it's trespass. Just the implication of violence, that he might haul you off to jail, that is sufficient. There's another cause of action called trespass on the case. Four words. Trespass on the case is the same as trespass except for one point, and that is that there's not the element of violence involved. So if somebody sweet talks you out of $1,000, well, that's a trespass, but there was no violence there. Okay, you volunteered. But still, it was a wrong and caused you an injury, so you sue for trespass on the case. A lot of times it's a mixture, so you can sue for both trespass and trespass on the case in the same cause of action. So it's up to you how you structure it. But the thing is that in a common law cause of action, or in a common law lawsuit, such in a court of record, you've got to go according to common law procedure, and so that's, you pick one of those common, those causes of action in order to be in the right procedure. Okay, so that is one of the requirements of a court of record, is that it's proceeding according to common law procedure. The fourth requirement is my favorite, because it is what I consider the killer requirement. This is the one that says that the tribunal is independent of the magistrate. Okay? Now, let me find something here. Here's what the California Penal Code says. It says the following persons are magistrates, the judges of the superior courts. So if the tribunal, that's the one who does the judging, is independent of the magistrate, that means the judge cannot exercise any tribunal functions. In other words, he cannot make any judgments. He's totally stripped of the authority in a court of record. Okay? So this is all in the law of the case. We have here the definition of what a court of record is. Okay? We put that in there. To be a court of record, a court must have four characteristics and may have a fifth. The fifth one is optional. A judicial tribunal having attributes and exercising functions independently of the person of the magistrate. Okay? Proceeding according to the course of common law. Okay? Its acts and judicial proceedings are enrolled or recorded for perpetual memory and testimony. In other words, it keeps a record. And has the power to fine or imprison for contempt. So there you have it. And all of this leads back to Blackstone's commentaries on the law of England. Okay, this is where this comes from. And it is supported by case law. We have case law in California, where the Supreme Court of California recognized what a court of record is and specifically named those four requirements. The fifth requirement, well, it's not a requirement. The fifth factor is that it may or it may not have a seal. A court does not have to have a seal. Okay? There were poor kings who couldn't afford a seal. So, anyway, that's what the court of record is. So, when you are running your case, let's go back to our procedure here. Here's how it works. The first thing that happens is that you make a complaint. Now, if you really want to get technical, the word complaint applies to equity proceedings. If it's a common law proceeding, it's called an action. However, it really doesn't matter. And the reason it doesn't matter is that whenever you write your lawsuit, it really doesn't matter what you call it. Titles do not control. What controls is the actual body of what you wrote. And one time, I remember there was this case where the defendant did a demurrer. Now, let me explain what a demurrer is. Whenever you make a complaint or a counterclaim or an action, that's your accusation, okay? And in your accusation, you put the facts, you put the law, and you're asking for the remedy, okay? The normal thing would be for the opposition to now answer it. They will answer with the law, they'll answer with the facts, and they'll answer was their denial of the remedy, okay? So that's your normal, what you have in your attack and defense. However, what a lot of times will happen is the opposition will do what's called a demur. What's a demur? A demur is simply a paper that only deals with the law. Whenever you get a demur, automatically the person who did the demur has agreed to the facts. You see, a demur is actually half an answer. It's the law side of the answer. And when anybody does a demur, they've agreed to the facts. Now, when that happens, the court gets this demur, typically a motion for demur, and you treat it like a motion, you reply, and so forth. And then the court makes a decision. Of course, if you're the sovereign in court, you make the decision. But the court makes a decision. And when it makes a decision, whatever is. And now the court goes to the next step. And the next step depends upon the court. It is the discretion of the court as to what the next step is. And the next step is one of two things. It either orders a trial or it goes straight to judgment. Guess which one I choose?
Trial.
Are you kidding? I'm the decision maker. It's a court of record. I'll go straight to judgment. Why do I want a trial? Okay? They agreed to all the facts. The only time you have a trial is if there's any doubt about what the real facts are. If they agreed to all the facts, and on reading it, you find that all the facts are very clear, then there's no need for a trial on the facts. See, that's what a trial is about. Any trial has to do with the facts. It doesn't have to do with the law. See, the law is already known. The question is, are the facts reliable? Are the facts actually facts? And that's for the court to determine. But the court doesn't have to determine it if the other side admits it and says, yeah, all those facts are true. And when they do a demur, that's exactly what the other side said. It said all those facts are true. I say, thank you very much. I like that. So you get the demur. That demur is your key to the judgment. You go from there. Now, if the facts are fuzzy, then you need a trial, because that's how you determine what the facts are. But normally, if you do your good writing and you put together your complaint properly, then the facts are there. They should be clear. So, anyway, here's how it works. Let's go further down here, I think. I don't have it right here. I got the wrong file. See if this is it. Nope, that's not it. All right. This must be it. Action at law example. Yeah. Elements of a common law action. Okay? Okay. Yeah, it's a little too big. Okay. So here's basically what gets filed. First of all, you have the declaration or complaint or action, whatever you want to call it. The bottom line is that you have to certify it. You have to verify that complaint. That means that at the end of the complaint, you will say, I declare under penalty of perjury that the foregoing facts are true and correct. Okay? Now, I know some people have a religious objection to declaring something under perjury. Well, let me tell you something. This court process is secular. It's not religious, okay? And all you're saying when you're declaring a penalty of perjury, you're saying that if you catch me lying, I'm willing to go to jail, okay? If you're not lying, then you don't go to jail. So you make your declaration. You don't have to get it notarized. Okay. In fact, California codes recognize that if you make a declaration under penalty of perjury, that's equivalent to having it notarized. And that applies everywhere except when you're dealing with real estate. In real estate, the notary is mandatory in certain instances. But other than that, you make up a declaration, you can just say, I declare under penalty of perjury that the foregoing is true and correct, and then that is sufficient for the same as going before a notary. The theory behind that is that it's hard to lie when you're face-to-face with a person, okay? When you declare to the notary that you're telling the truth, so help you God, then that, because you're face-to-face, there's a pressure on you to tell the truth. If you're not face-to-face, it's easier to lie on paper. So the compensation for that is to have you make a declaration under penalty of perjury. That's why that's in there. Okay? So you make your declaration, you put in the law, you put in the facts, and then the opposition has a chance to respond. And so step two is for the opposition to demur or to plead. Those are the two choices. If the opposition demurs, then there's just an issue of law. The facts have been agreed to, so you can go straight to judgment or you can continue the process. And that's by order of the court. The court decides that, okay, not the parties. But if they do a full answer, in other words, they do a pleading, then step three is the replication. Or in other words, in modern English, we say you reply. And when you respond, it's called a replication or a peremptory pleading or a demur. You can demur too, in which case now the rules are reversed. You've agreed to whatever facts preceded and you're just raising issues of law. Okay? So then if you go beyond that, step four is a rejoinder. And pretty much the same concepts apply. And then you have surrejoiners, and then you have a rebutter, and you have a surrebutter, and a rebutter, and a surrebutter again, and then from that point on, it's just surrebutters and rebutters. Okay? It is our custom that there are only three papers. That's why you have the dashed line here. You make your accusation, and you have full opportunity to state your case. They make their answer. And they have full opportunity to make their answer. And then they can include the affirmative defenses. The affirmative defenses mean that they're bringing in new information. Let's say party A sues party B because party B punched him in the eye. Okay? So party B in his answer says, yep, that's all true. Yeah, I punched him in the eye. Okay? But he's demurring. He's agreeing. Oh, all those facts are true. Yeah, I punched him in the eye. But he brings in an issue of law. And he says, the reason I punched him in the eye was because he attacked me first, self-defense. So your affirmative defense is that it was an act of self-defense because the plaintiff was the original aggressor. That's what affirmative defenses are all about. So when you plead that, or when you, in your demur, or even your answer, you put, you challenge the facts, and you say that it was self-defense, and you put in the facts are there, that's when the plaintiff can respond to the new information. In your replication, or in other words, your reply to the defendant's answer, you do not restate everything that was in your original complaint. Okay? They don't like that. You told them once, you don't have to shoot the horse a second time. But in your reply, you attack specifically the information that was the new information that came in through their answer. Okay? That kind of adds to the efficiency of the proceedings. Now, one of the things that I like to do in a lawsuit is a matter of strategy. See, in strategy, you don't necessarily do everything you can do. All right? You don't say everything you could say. I really learned a lesson one time from the Georgia case. There was this Georgia case where the jury awarded the largest award ever awarded in the history of Georgia by a jury. What it was that there was an accident, and there was a whole line of cars stopped for the accident. A semi came up over the hill at excessive speed, came down, cleared out all the cars, and continued on. The last car in that chain of cars had a little girl in it that got killed. So, there's a big lawsuit over that. I forgot the other part. There was a second truck by the same company following the first truck. He came up over the hill and took advantage of the clearance and went on through the pathway cleared by the first truck and did not stop to help or aid. So everybody got sued on this deal. The defending company demanded discovery. They wanted to see all the evidence. So they got the evidence. And part of the evidence was a whole bunch of little film clips. Okay? And so they said, here it is. They gave them the film clips. And then the defense could analyze it or whatever. But you see, it was just evidence. It was not strategy. Okay? When in discovery, you have an obligation to show your evidence, but you don't have an obligation to show how you're going to use it. Okay? So when it came time for trial, and this is kind of a tearjerker in a way, but when it came time for trial, they presented the evidence, and they showed these film clips. Well, there was a film clip right in the middle of the evidence that they gave them on discovery that they then moved to the end. Same evidence. Nobody can complain. You got the evidence. But they put this at the end. Now, remember, this whole lawsuit had to do with the fact that this little girl never got a chance to grow up, loss of future hope, future life, future anything you can imagine. Okay? And so they were building this story on how this loss was. And the last scene that showed was this home movie, this little girl, 5 years old, saying, bye, bye bye, bye. The largest award ever presented in the history of Georgia. So, strategy is one thing, facts are another. Okay? The opposition was not prepared for that one. And yet, there was the evidence given to them as requested. Okay. That taught me a lot when I read that one. So, you have your strategy. If there's discovery, sure. You want to know what the facts are? Go ahead. And you're free to arrange it any way you want. You know? Those are the facts. You didn't lie. Okay, so in our modern procedure, we limit it to three papers. If they want to go a fourth, I mean, under common law procedure, you'd have to recognize it. But they don't. They're attorneys. They don't know the common law procedure. They think it's all equity. So you make your presentation, they make their answer, response, whatever, and you make your reply, replication, whatever, and then it stops there. And basically, you know, the beautiful thing about the common law is that the common law is very simple very straightforward, no BS, as far as I'm concerned. It's pretty simple. And you don't go to court. You don't have to go to court. The reason you don't have to go to court, well, let me explain what motions are. I'm sure you've all seen motions in court. The pattern of a motion is similar to the pattern of a complaint. You can think of a motion as being a mini lawsuit within the lawsuit. Okay? In a motion, you make your accusation. They answer the accusation, or they demur. And then you reply to the new information that they brought in on their response. Okay? And then the court makes a ruling on this minor point, and then you get back to the main case. Okay? So, as a strategy, what I like to do is, first of all, I don't deal with all cases, you know, because there are some cases that are simply like typical drug cases. A person is accused of having drugs. If it's a false accusation, that's one thing. But if it's a real accusation, I kind of throw up my hands on this. You went looking for trouble and you found it, you know. If you didn't take the proper precautions to protect yourself. In my opinion, if you're not hurting anybody else, it's none of my business. But in the opinion of the state, that seems to be a problem. So what I like to do is I like to adopt my sovereign position, only I don't say I'm sovereign. I say I'm one of the people. And as one of the people, I question their jurisdiction because, after all, the codes which they are obligated to obey, I'm not, but they are, say that we the people do not yield our sovereignty to the agencies which serve us. So by what authority, if I'm one of the people, do they presume to take command of my life? So in my lawsuit, now this example of a counterclaim is about, again, it's approaching 10 years old. So since that time, I've maybe refined a couple of thoughts about it. So on a jurisdictional question, I'll say I've examined the evidence, examined the laws, and I see no evidence of jurisdiction. And therefore, I deny the jurisdiction. Very simple statement. Now, what that does is that, you see, whenever you are the accuser, the burden on you is to prove that you have the authority or you have the facts or whatever. But there's one exception to that. And the exception is, whenever you challenge jurisdiction, the burden shifts over to the other side and they have to prove their jurisdiction. Okay? So I minimize, I'm not going to give them the ammunition. I'm not their attorney. They all say they're attorneys at law. That means common law. The fact that they're all trained in equity only, case law and statutes and codes and rules and regulations, well, I might feel sorry for them if they would admit it. But since they claim they're attorneys at law, and they claim their authorities at law, well, then I have no obligation to accommodate them. So I just say, well, hey, I don't see any evidence of jurisdiction. It's up to you to prove it.
There's a classic Supreme Court case addressing that very issue. I'm sure you're familiar with this, Combs versus Virginia. Combs versus Virginia. I think it's 19 U.S., it's 4 Wheat, or 6 Wheat, 192 at 404. And it says we can no more refuse to take jurisdiction when we should than to take it when we shouldn't. Either is treason against the Constitution.
Right.
That's an 1821 case, and it's never been overturned. K-O-H-E-N-S versus Virginia.
Okay. I will note that.
Google that or get it on Fine Law.
Combs versus Virginia. What? Are you sure of the case?
Yeah, I think it's 19 U.S., it's either 4 or 6 wheat, 192 at 404, 1821. It's a very, very long case.
Well, you've mixed your sites. It's either U.S. or it's wheat, but not both.
Well, then it's...
There's two designations. They can be both refer to the same case, but they're two designations.
I think it's 19 U.S. It might be 17, but if you Google it, it'll bring it up.
Well, I'll go you one step further, since it is a Supreme Court case. So let's look at the database. I've got a database of all the Supreme Court cases.
Page 404.
Well, okay. I'm bringing it up now. This is called thelaw.net. It's really a good database. So we will go to Cones versus Virginia. When?
1821, I believe.
I hope your belief is correct. Can we trust your belief system?
We'll find out.
Okay, we're going to do keyword search.
How are you spelling Cones?
K-O-N-E-S.
No, C-O-N-E-S.
Okay.
C-O-N-E-S.
All right.
Is there any ice cream available?
C-O-H-N-E-S.
You need to settle down on something. C-O-H-N-E-S versus Virginia.
Yeah, I believe that's correct.
Here we go, belief systems again.
21.
Okay. And we just want the Supreme Court cases.
It might be C-O-H-N-S, but it should pull it up.
Okay, we'll see. Nope, didn't find it that way.
C-O-H-N-S.
C-O-H-N-S versus Virginia. 1890-21.
Cones is not being spelled, and I can't see that far without...
C-O-H-N-S is what you said. C-O-H-N-S.
C-O-N-H-S.
I don't think so. C-O-N-H, that doesn't occur in the English language.
C-O-N...
I'll tell you what, let's take a different approach. What was the Wheatstone quote or the U.S. site? Give me either site. Just the site.
19 U.S. 192.
19 U.S. 192. Okay, let's do that one. Okay. This is an actual citation lookup.
We found it.
How do you spell
Cones?
It's
right here.
C-O-H-E-N-S versus Virginia.
C-O-H-E-N-S.
Oh, it's Cohen's, not Cones.
Yeah, right. C-O-N.
C-O-H-E-N-S versus Virginia.
Yeah, C-O.
Give me the actual site.
C-O-H-E-N-S. Wikipedia.
No, give me the site. The site means the number and then the book.
19 U.S.C. 264.
You said it.
Yeah, but I didn't remember.
19 U.S. 264.
Yeah.
264. 21. I was right on the year.
Uh-oh.
Right on the state. It's still in Como.
Yeah.
Right on the state.
My computer shuts off when it overheats. It overheated, so.
Can you pull up, buddy? Can you go down a page?
Sure, I could use that.
Yeah, go down to page 404. Scroll down.
I got to get out of your way first.
This is the enemy.
So you got a hot property there, huh?
I sure do. Excepting that I can't look up the case with your computer.
It's right there. It's already on there.
Okay. Yeah.
It's online.
Sure.
COHES.
Let's see.
ENS.
Cohen.
The Jewish name.
Okay. Let's see now.
Yep, can you fill it here? Can you fill it with some books?
That's it right there. Let's see if something shows up. How about that? Okay, Cohen's versus Virginia.
Now scroll down to page 404.
Okay.
And it was, let me see, what is, oh, 264 U.S., yeah. So if you scroll down to page 404, they usually have the pages.
I think that's the right. Well,
if you scroll down, it should give you the pages.
Yeah, it normally does. I was going to take a shortcut and just go straight to the page by searching for 404.
In fine law, if you.
Yeah.
Go on the bottom of the external links.
Are those my eyes or yours?
They are.
Okay, thank you.
Find the law of justice.
Very bottom, it says.
Very bottom.
Well, almost to the very bottom.
Fine law, see right there on the, go over to fine law.
Right to the right.
Right to the right of the down external
down
links.
Down.
There you go.
There.
Left.
To the left now.
It says fine law.
Just here.
Yeah. Okay. That'll give us a complete case. Well, if it starts on page 264, then page 404 is quite a waste. They said a lot in that decision. There it is. So now we'll go down to 404.
And look right about there. It should.
This is 377.
Yeah. We want 404.
Let's see. That's 419. We're getting there. 412. 402. 405. Here we are. We're on 404 now. Right here. Is this number after or before?
It starts there.
No, the number 404, does it appear at the end of the page or the beginning of the page?
Beginning of the page.
Okay, then there we are. Okay. If his plea should be overruled and judgment rendered against him, his case would resemble this. And unless the jurisdiction of this court might be exercised over it, the Constitution would be...
Oh, no, it's the next paragraph. The next paragraph starts...
It is most true that this court will not take jurisdiction if it should not, but it is equally true that it must take jurisdiction if it should. The judiciary cannot, as the legislature may, avoid a measure just because it approaches the confines of the Constitution. We cannot pass it by because it is doubtful. With whatever doubts, with whatever difficulties, a case may be attended, we must decide it if it be brought before us. We have no more right to decline the exercise of jurisdiction, which is given, than to usurp that which is not given. The one or the other would be treason to the Constitution.
That's powerful.
Questions may occur which we would gladly avoid, but we cannot avoid them. All we can do is to exercise our best judgment and conscientiously to perform our duty. In doing this, on the present occasion, we find this tribunal invested with appellate jurisdiction in all cases arising under the Constitution and laws of the United States. We find no exception to this grant, and we cannot insert one. And as long as we're talking about the Constitution and jurisdiction, the people, according to the preamble, created the Constitution. So the people are outside the Constitution. Plus, the Constitution specifically says in the preamble that we created it for the government, for the United States of America. It was not created for us. So we, the people, are outside the Constitution, operating in self-government, real self-government, okay? So the government has no jurisdiction over you. Even if you commit a crime, there's no jurisdiction. It has to be the people that come against you. And the grand jury, a common law grand jury, is one of the means for the people to come against you. In fact, they can come against you on anything, okay? But if there's no grand jury, then the only one who can come against you is the one who you injured. Okay? So...
Or the jury.
No, the jury is not the plaintiff. The jury is the judge.
But they're the people that come against
you. No. No, the jury doesn't come against you. The grand jury can come against you, but not the petite jury. If you just say jury, I assume you're talking about the petite jury. Yeah, the grand jury can come against you.
Regular grand jury like it means today?
Well, what do you call a regular grand jury?
When they elect two people there in the grand jury.
You're talking about the 23 people that are over there by government assignment? That's not a grand jury. Not in the common law sense. It's a grand jury because they chose to call it a grand jury. But it's totally statutory.
Make you waive your immunity when you appear before them?
Well, you'd counterclaim them. If you got a grand jury indictment, you'd counterclaim them and you would challenge their authority as a common law grand jury. Because the Magna Carta says that a grand jury consists of 25 people. So how can it be 23? In Orange County...
I wish I knew that
grand jury. In Orange County, the grand jury... statutory grand jury made some severe comments about the computer department of Orange County. And they put a full report on it and were very, very critical. And the supervisor who had responsibility for that area of government, his response was, well, that may be their opinion, but they really don't know, don't understand the processes that go on and so forth, okay? Now, if that had been a real grand jury, he couldn't have got away with that.
Well, you know, one time I went into the...
Speak up loud.
I went into the...
Louder.
Louder.
Mm-hmm. He has to hear you over there.
No, I got to hear.
Into the room where the chief, so-called chief justice is in Santa Ana. And that's where the grand jury, that you go in there, that's where all that goes on. But mm-hmm. my question is, supposedly... the chief magistrate for all the judges is really a park ranger. Is that true?
Well, there are all these theories running around, and there's a legal maxim that says fine points of the law are not law. So you can slice and dice and cut and segregate and sort and so forth, and I don't pay any attention to that. Here's what I do. When I go to court, it's very simple. Somebody hurt me, and he's responsible. Give him any title you want. If he hurt me, and I can prove it, I should be compensated for my injury. Okay? I don't care if they have all these descriptions. You want to call yourself a park ranger? Okay. But you did hurt me, so now pay.
But then it says that you have to be, you have to have a court order by a judge.
Well, you do in equity.
And then these people are not judges, though.
Well... then, well, if he's not a judge, let's say he's a commissioner.
Yeah.
Okay, if you read the rules closely, their rules, okay, not my rules. And their rules say that, well, their rules do say that if a commissioner makes a decision, then you have, I guess it's 1 or 2 weeks to post your protest to the real judges, and then they will decide whether or not to stick with that decision or change it. So if you don't change it, the rules say then it is the same as if a judge had made the decision. So you have to apprise yourself of their rules if you are going to operate in their rule system.
Well, then you shouldn't have to abide by time limits either.
You shouldn't have to what?
You shouldn't have to abide by their time limits either.
That's correct. You don't have to abide by their time limits. But again, what is the definition of a court? And I say the real definition is that it's a stage upon which you put a show in order to convince the rest of the world why you're right. Don't speak English in a Chinese court. Okay? Make yourself follow those rules, even though it's unofficial, because that's what they understand. Sure, you can fight it, you can battle it out and show them that, well, those rules don't apply, but all that does is give you more work to do. I suggest that if you just make sure that you go along with their system unofficially, but you're doing it, they won't object because they think those are the rules. And now you can get on with the real business of your court instead of having to have these side battles. Remember what Abraham Lincoln said. If you don't want to argue a point, don't bring it up. Okay? If you're going to violate the rules effectively, their rules, you're effectively bringing up the point. And sure, you could win, but are you a fighter or are you a winner? I'd rather win than fight. So,
but what if it's in your benefit to take forever?
Well, if it's important enough, you push the point, sure. But I suggest you don't do it because I usually find it's to my benefit not to have to waste time arguing those points. Just get on the stick and do the job. You know, 30 days normally should be enough. When you're learning, it's tougher. But then you can make a motion to your court for more time and then turn around and okay it.
What do you know about the canons of the judge?
What are the judge's judicial canons? I don't care what they are because he has no power. See, the judicial canons and the oath of office, the purpose of that is to make sure he does the job as defined for him. Well, his job as defined for him now in a court of record is that he's not to make any decisions. Black and white issue.
And then what if he does anyhow?
Well, then you do a writ of error. If he makes a decision anyway, you do a writ of error to correct him. If he does it a second time, you not only do another writ of error, but you also fine him for contempt of court. And if he does it again, you increase the fine.
What if he doesn't pay?
Oh, we don't care if he pays or not. It's part of the record. And you report that record to the judicial conference. And here's a guy who's bucking the system. Okay, because that is our system that I'm talking about. See, if you look at the website, the motto on the website is, through the courts, encouraging the government to obey the law. Okay, that's what we're doing. We want them to obey the law.
I've talked to a few people that have gone to that judicial council.
Yeah, they didn't get any results, right? Okay, that's a misunderstanding of what the judicial council is. The purpose of the judicial council is to deal with judges. It is not to deal with your case. You are not going to get any results for your case from the judicial council. If the judge misbehaved, they will carefully make a note. If they get enough complaints, he's going to lose his career.
What's enough?
I don't know. But whatever it is, in their opinion, it is. I make sure I report to the judicial council with an affidavit, maybe using their forms, maybe not, because I want to build the record against the judge. I will then move on with my case, independent of whatever I sent to the judicial council. The purpose of the judicial council is not to get involved in your case, but rather to get involved with his career. So, make your complaint and let it go at that. Move on. Same thing with attorneys. You complain to the Bar Association and then you move on. If you have to, in your own case, if you want to make a motion for sanctions against the attorney or sanctions against the judge, you can do that too. That all becomes more of the record to report to the Bar Association and report to the Council on Judicial Performance.
But what if they're busy making so many sanctions against you, though?
But they don't apply. You see, if they make sanctions against you, then what you do is you issue a writ of error because there's no authority to do a sanction against you. How can the owner of the court be told by the servants what's right or wrong? Okay? Ultimately, you are the boss.
But that's not true for the Court of Equity. They can make sanctions on
that. Oh, in the Court of Equity, the chancellor, who is erroneously called a judge, sits there with complete authority to do anything he wants. He's like a king. The king's not there, so he acts instead of the king. Okay?
And if you go further with that, if I'm a member of one of the people, I never gave him authority to get to that point.
Well, there's another legal maxim. It says that the law does not protect he who slumbers on his rights. If you want to be asleep on the job when they do something to you and you don't do a writ of error, you don't do sanctions against them, you don't do whatever's necessary legally, and they get away with it, that's your fault.
But what if I was a baby when all that was decided?
Well, there's no statute of limitations. You might even sue your parents for not protecting you.
But how could...
Now, come on, how far do you want to carry the hypotheticals, okay? Are you in charge or not when you bring in your court?
Not really.
Oh, well, then, if that's your attitude... You know, guess what? You're going to get what you believe in. Okay? I go in with an attitude. My attitude is, but it isn't just an arbitrary attitude. It's an attitude based on our traditions, our legal traditions. A court of record, the plaintiff owns it. Okay? You're the king or the queen. All right? Now, if you have doubts about that, they're going to walk all over you, and they're going to laugh.
Well, what happens if all along you've been a so-called defendant in the Court of Equity?
You learn to eat.
You want to shift.
You eat doo-doo, and you learn to love the taste of it.
But how do you shift over to...
I just told you how.
That's how you
do a counterclaim.
A counterclaim.
Yeah. Okay. You sue back, and the number one cause of action has to do with jurisdiction. Sure. By what authority do you presume to take me over? Okay. And you leave it at that. When they answer, the burden is on them to provide all the evidence and proof, not just opinion, not assumption, but actual proof that they have jurisdiction over you. They have to produce a contract. They have to produce something that, whatever it is, they can imagine. Mm-hmm. And you are the judge. So you decide whether or not what they provided is adequate. But you can't be arbitrary. It actually has to make sense. When you trash their arguments, trash it with authority. In other words, you can show by their case law, by their black letter law, by their constitution, that they didn't have the authority.
Black letter law.
What it is that when laws were passed by the legislature, they were printed in big black letters. All the commentary and all was printed in little letters. So black letter law means the actual statements made by the legislature. That's what black letter law is.
But is it true? Okay, let's say I've heard that the Congress isn't even making many decisions that are happening now. It's all these little committees, different kinds.
That's right.
Of committees.
And in fact, the decisions are now being made by the super committee. The Congress is only saying yay or nay, but not actually introducing true law. Okay, and they've agreed to do that. That's an informal agreement. Okay, it's not right. They're not representing us anymore. They're representing the power structure.
So then can all the people get together and make a point of error on that?
Well, I think you could sue them if it affects you. You have to show an injury in order to get the jurisdiction as an individual. There's no class action suits. Although you might have 1 million plaintiffs. That's possible.
Interesting.
Yeah. You have to show an injury. Okay? Yes.
At the beginning, when we were talking and you were presenting it and we were going into the business of you being the plaintiff, it is my understanding that we have two court systems. One established by the Constitution of 1849, and then one, we have two constitutions, and the second one, which was, I believe, 1879.
Correct.
And since, which is the corporate constitution. Am I correct in that statement?
Well, I don't know how you classify them, but I tell you what I do. Look, the gang I'm dealing with, to me, they're like the Chinese. So I'm going to speak Chinese to them, okay? I'll speak the language they understand. Now, the language they understand is the 1879 Constitution. Okay? So, all right. As long as, you see, in my sovereign capacity, I have unlimited power to contract. So I'm happy to contract with them that the 1879 Constitution will be the basic set of rules that we go by. Now, what does the basic set of rules say? Well, if you look at Article 6, Section 1, it says all the courts in California are courts of record. Well, great. I'll be the plaintiff, and we'll proceed accordingly. Thank you very much. Court of record proceeds according to the common law, doesn't it? Well, okay. Hey, you tell me what your rules are. There was a fun case one time. Let's see, I guess I'll have to go.
What do you think of the idea of bringing your own private dictionary there? And if they ask, you ask them, what kind of dictionary do they go by? And then you have the redneck's dictionary with you.
In your sovereign capacity, you can do anything you want. But there is one rule that I try really hard not to violate. Okay? It's an unwritten rule. The rule is that a court is a stage upon which you put a show in order to prove that you, the sovereign, are right in your decision. Now, that rule overrides all the other rules. If you can convince the other side that your position is justified, that you are right, and so forth, they'll support you.
Well, if you say that you're trying to prove what a word means, for instance, then, like, say, what rule or what definition are you going by?
Would that be part of your good show? Would that be part of your good show?
Well, what I'm saying is, like, if a specific word means something different in the Black Law Dictionary, that means this, you can ask them legitimately what dictionary are they going by.
Why would you ask them? Why don't you just tell them? It's your court. You make the decision.
Well, although they're not accusing you of something.
Well, of course they are, but you do a counterclaim.
Right.
Now it's your court, and you're the judge. So if you're the judge, why are you, I can hear the tone in your voice that you're giving them credibility.
Okay.
You're acknowledging they threw a rock in the pond and you're acknowledging the ripples they made.
Going along with it.
Yeah, you're rolling with it.
Okay.
You know, make your own decisions. But again, understand that you're not an island. You know, you've heard that no man is an island.
Right.
So it's very serious when I say that a court is a stage. You're putting on a show. By all means, put on the best show you can. That means follow the rules that apply, suspend the rules that don't apply, but make it a good showing when you do it. Okay? You're not there to fight. You are there to win. Now, if you want to fight, do the opposite of what Abraham Lincoln says. Just go ahead and bring something up. Now we'll fight over it. Yeah, we solved that one. Now let's go on to the next point. Let's spread. Is it a corporation or is it government? Okay. Is it a corporate constitution or a constitution of the people? I mean, you're getting all these arguments, you know. Does a birth certificate mean I'm under your jurisdiction? Believe me, when they answer, they're not going to say those things. They're not going to bring that up.
Have you ever been in a court proceeding where they tried to tell you to be quiet? Like, in other words, like...
Absolutely.
Tried to tell you you can't...
Absolutely. Although I've never been in one like that when it was my court.
Okay. Like, in other words, when these people that, like in these cases that have to do with medical companies, like say medical companies.
Medical.
No, he just has to get something.
Oh, I see.
In these whistleblower cases, in the medical companies.
Look, you made your...
Bill, can we get on with Bill's presentation? This thing has gotten totally off point.
Okay.
And what is the point?
Well, we want to hear the rest of your procedural presentation.
Well, this is part of it, actually, because here she's bringing up questions of procedure. What do you do and what is and what if they do that? But my answer is common. Whenever they do something that's improper, you do an objection, and if the judge presumes the authority and asks you why you object, you tell him it's not your wish. And if he says that, well, that's not good enough. If that's the best you can do, you're overruled. And then you say, nevertheless, for the record, I object, and shut up. You don't have to argue the point anymore. You've made your point. Then later, you create a writ of error which totally cancels out anything the judge did. And there's examples of writs of error at 1215.org/Q. And when you've made your writ of error, and he still ignores it, he does it again, you do another writ of error, a second one. This is number two. And you fine him $1 for contempt of court, which he will never pay because he's poor. Okay? And so you have that against him. And, of course, you report it to the Council on Judicial Performance. And if he does it a second time, you raise the fine. Another writ of error and a greater fine. Okay? And then if he does it a third time, you ratchet up their fines. You might get up after about the sixth time. You might be up around $500-$600. And then after that, you come out with a bench warrant to arrest him because he's disrespectful of the court. Okay? I mean, and there's an example of that on the website, 1215.org, where we actually issued a bench warrant against the judge. Read it, because it explains everything. It explains why the authority is there to issue the bench warrant. So, but what my own experience has been, if you do the job right in the beginning, then the judges will fall in line. Because, you see, when you run your case, you should not be arbitrary. Remember, your case is a stage upon which you conduct your case, okay? And if you do a good job of showing the world why it is that you're right, then the judges, seeing that you are being reasonable, seeing that you're being lawful, they sit back and relax because they realize this is real law. They've never seen that in their court before. They only knew equity. And not only that, but you're not being unreasonable. And on top of that, there's one more thing that you do. And that is that the... What's that? You need power.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I think it's on this side.
It's one or two.
You got two of them? No, just one.
It's not that?
Nope. No, that...
It's charging now.
That's something, I forget. Fire something. Anyway, see, you have to keep in mind the rest of the world. But that does not mean you don't have the authority. But you have to make it clear. You got to conduct a nice, clear case where any 10-year-old could read your case and understand it. And by the way, that's the level you write on, okay? You have to assume that a 10-year-old is making the decisions when they read it. So, okay, keep it on that simple level.
I'm sorry, Fred, but I was just trying to think of this word, and I couldn't think of
it. Well, it doesn't matter, because you're the decider. You decide what it is, but again, be reasonable. And, you know, I like to, if there is a word conflict, I go back to Webster's 1828 dictionary, okay? It's available on the Internet, and you can get a definition out of it, okay?
What I was trying to think of is whatever it is that the judge is able, in an equity or another court, able to make you be quiet, like for years, or never speak again on something. That's
yeah, well, look, if he exceeds... Look, you're slicing and dicing and so forth. You missed the main point. Do you remember what the main point is?
Yes.
What?
That you're the king or queen of your own court.
That is true, but that's...
Your attitude has to be that you're in charge.
Yes, but that's not the main point in this particular thing you brought up. The main point is he can't do anything at all. He's dead in the water.
Right.
Period. It doesn't matter if he brought up the dictionary or if he brought up a rule he made up.
Okay.
Either way, the fundamental premise is he can't make any decisions whatsoever. He cannot order anything.
Okay.
He's dead as far as you're concerned. And so you correct him. Like I said, I've had judges issue orders in my favor. And I bounce them out. Because I don't allow a judge to make a decision in my court. Okay? Or, if I choose to allow it, if I actually allow it, I will then issue a sovereign order ratifying his decision. he made the decision. Yeah, I support that. That's okay. I'm the boss, so I say it's okay. Now, we have his order backed up by my sovereign authority. And I don't say I'm sovereign. Yes?
Quick question.
No such thing.
According to Article 6, you said all courts are courts of record.
That's correct.
Including small claims?
They don't say small claims, but small claims doesn't exist. In California, it's all the Superior Court of California. They subdivided the sub, you know, they have a specialty. So they made up a special set of rules for their specialty, but it's still the Superior Court. And the Constitution says the Superior Court is a court of record. So, yeah, I guess it would be. The only thing is that if I do a counterclaim, I'm going to follow their rules and give them an excuse to dump the case into a higher court. For example, the small claims is limited to $10,000, right? Yeah, and the municipal level, which they don't call it anymore, the Court of Limited Claims, they're limited to $25,000. So I sue for $25,001. Okay? Now, when I go to court, I'll make a motion to the court, to the judge, in their court. I'll make a motion to have it transferred to the other court because it exceeded his jurisdiction. He cannot judge the counterclaim. See, that'll take it out of small claims and put it into big claims. See. So that would be a procedure I would follow if I were in that case. I've never done it, but I was in small claims one time and I saw an attorney do it.
Attorneys can't be in a small claim.
They can on a counterclaim.
Yeah, on a counterclaim, you're right.
And they're suing for more, and the motion was made to have it transferred, and the judge said fine because it was outside his jurisdiction. He could not judge the counterclaim and the small claim at the same time, but he's required to for a counterclaim. Okay? He has to. Well, since it's out of his jurisdiction, he had no choice. In order to keep the case alive, he had to obey the motion and transfer it over to the court that did have the authority.
What about judge pro tems, which are nothing but attorneys?
That's just like a commissioner, as far as I'm concerned. He's not a real judge. And in fact, the judges are not real judges. Why? Because they have no authority in a court of record. I don't care who they are. I don't care about whoever they are. It's not an equity case. It's a case at law. And what is the law? Read the law of the case. And it's anything I made up. You know, I'm sure most of you have heard me express my law about pink shoes. Okay, anybody here who has not heard my law in pink shoes?
I haven't.
You haven't? Whew. What color shoes are you wearing?
Black ones.
Black ones? You're pretty lucky.
You know. Wearing red ones.
No, it's specifically, I have a pink shoe law. You see, I'm the sovereign, and the decree of the sovereign makes law. And so I'm offended any time anybody wears pink shoes in my presence. In fact, I'm so offended that I attach a death penalty on it. Okay? I don't allow pink shoes in my presence. Not voluntarily. Now, I have to acknowledge that I've had a little problem enforcing that law because they can ask for a jury and the juries have jury nullification. Okay? But nevertheless, that is my law. Okay? Now, I have another law which says that if I'm minding my own business walking down the sidewalk and somebody sneaks up behind me and injures me, knocks me down, breaks a bone, that I think that person should go to jail for 30 days and compensate me for my medical expenses. Okay? What do you think the chances are that I'd be able to enforce that through a jury?
Pretty good.
I would think so. So, you see, the jury is the great leveler. The jury has the power to either accept or reject the law. They can accept or reject the facts. They have total authority in a court of record. Okay? They are the real judges.
The law and the facts.
The law and the facts both.
Now, in the court of record, there's nobody to give them directions, to give them the jury directions on how they should consider things?
Oh, yeah, the sovereign will give them directions.
Really?
Sure.
Not the judge.
Well, no. Who's he?
He's no one.
Okay, so why are you bringing him up? You keep giving him credibility.
I'm just curious. I'm just used to him always taking over.
So you're a fighter, not a winner. Is that what you're saying? Exactly. You like to bring up these side issues that have no relevancy. Mm-hmm. See, yes, sir.
Is there a way to get the IRS off my back using common law? And the background of this question is that every once in a while in this forum we hear somebody who's got a way to get away from the IRS, but it's always very complicated and really scary.
Well,
we have
always
a simple system for that.
It's always complicated when you follow their system. Okay?
There are remedies.
It's always complicated when you follow their system. However, there are other approaches. There's more than one way to skin a cat. You have an immediate something about that? Okay.
I have a 13-page memorandum at law that I can download.
Yeah, but who cares?
No. Since this was
Fred,
Since this was brought up, Fred. What?
Look, if you want to go into equity, you can do all that stuff. You can put in tremendous defenses. You can quote all the case law and so forth. As long as you're in equity, that judge can either accept or reject it.
This was written.
It's still
a
equity.
Memorandum at law, strike while the iron's hot, and has to do specifically with the IRS investigating these tea parties under the 501c4.
Look, you take that to into court, and who's going to make the decision on that information? The judge, right?
I'm not taking it to court.
Well, who's going to enforce it?
I took it to Daryl Issa and members of Congress showing
okay.
that the IRS is not an agency of the federal government.
Okay, so you converted it into a political question, and the IRS is afraid of politics. Fine, that's not law. Okay, so you intimidated them. Fine, sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. I want real power. I don't want this political stuff. I mean, if you can win doing that way, by all means do it. All right, but to me, I looked at this whole problem of procedure, and I said, I want the ultimate procedure that you get to. What if they didn't pay attention to you? You still end up in court. The court is the ultimate place where things are decided unless you can move the entire legislature to pass a special law on your behalf, okay, which has happened. But, you know, there was a guy who had a dime that the administration wanted to reclaim because it was defective. And Congress made a special law saying that if a dime is printed exactly this way, then whoever has possession of it must stay possession, could not sell it, could do anything, but could keep it. And that stopped the government from invading and taking that dime back. There actually was an issue over 10 cents.
That one case that you quoted, I find that interesting because it seems like if you look over history, there's the law and then there's public opinion.
So that's like, right, politics.
That case, that the multi-million case where the little girl died and they mm-hmm. showed the picture at the end.
But that was
won the case.
That was procedure inside the law. That was a strategy. But you have, to me, the ultimate arbiter of all conflicts is the court.
Right.
The next step is revolution.
Right.
Okay? So I want the courts to work. I'm a supporter of the court system.
So what you were saying is the strategy in law can be just as valuable as the law itself. Because
maybe more valuable.
Yeah, because that picture of the little girl was the
sure, but don't get a fixation on that.
No.
The real thing is that in the bigger picture, you can go to the legislature like he suggests, okay, and scare the bejeebus out of the IRS. Because they're afraid of new laws being passed. And that's great if you win that way. But if I want an actual hardcore decision in my favor, I'm going to the courts. Okay? That is the ultimate decider. And the ultimate decider is the court of record. Because the Supreme Court itself has said that any decision by a court of record is binding on all the courts of the world, just as if a Supreme Court decision would be binding on all the courts of the world. And then it went on to say that a decision by a court of record is binding on the Supreme Court itself. So it is not appealable.
It is powerful.
Yes, yes.
Bill, I think it seems to me I just have this question. Court of record and doing it that way, it can only be done pro se. You couldn't get an attorney to represent you.
You could have an attorney represent you. Now, what attorney do you know that would risk his license by doing this?
I don't know any.
Okay, well, then forget that argument. Okay? All right. So, you know, there's theory and then there's actual practicality. So no attorney is going to risk his license, and they'll find a way to get rid of him if he does key into some way to get rid of the power structure. Okay? So this is stuff that only you as an individual in practical terms can do. Okay? So anyway, where shall we go from here? Yes.
Well, back to my question. So what solution do you have for me if I want the IRS of my back?
Sue him. Counterclaim.
That's it.
Counterclaim.
So under 15 U.S.C. 1692 at SEEK and not under 26 U.S.C. They have.
See, that's what I'm scared of.
26.
This is what this whole 13 pager is about.
26 U.S.C. is law if you decree it as the sovereign of the court. Then it becomes law. Yes. Yes.
It's not legal evidence of the law.
In whose court?
In my court.
Well, go ahead. If you want to play that game, my court it is. I'll decree it so. You can decree it not so. See, the law of the case is the law of that particular case.
I understand that, but I'm...
Well, then why? Do you want to fight or do you want to win? I'm only going on.
Difficult tonight,
look, Bill. I'm only going on simple concepts.
I'm still in my house after 2.5 years after having been evicted. I must have done something right.
Yes, you did do something right.
Yes, he does.
You intimidated them to the point where they actually started maybe obeying their own rules. That's fine. That is a technique. I'm not saying that what I do is the only way to win. Okay, but I'm saying it's the only way where you have a lockstep power definition where your position is defined as being actually authoritative. All the other ways, you're relying on somebody saying, oh yeah, maybe you are right. Okay? Maybe the judge says, oh yeah, maybe you're right. Or the IRS says, yeah, looks like you're right. We might get in trouble if we do. We better go this way. No, I don't like that kind of guesswork. Yeah. So I want to go where I have positive control. Okay? And that's what this gives me. Yes, sir.
Back to Dan's question.
Yeah.
So he sues him in his court of record.
Right.
Hopefully he has a judgment for him.
What do you mean, hopefully?
Well, I don't know. I don't trust him as a judge.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. So okay. He finds for himself. How does he enforce it?
Well, it's easy. It's easy. There's procedures to follow. If a judgment comes out of a court of record, which is conducted in... the Constitution of the United States says in all cases in law and equity that arise under... the Constitution or the laws of the United States, the judicial power of the United States is available to that court. It's right in the Constitution.
You said law of equity.
Yeah, I said I included
law
equity.
Equity.
Oh, law and equity, is that what you said?
Yeah, I said law, all cases in law or whatever it is, and or are, it doesn't make any difference. Okay. The point is that if you have a case at law or if you have a case that's at equity, then the judicial power of the United States is available. That's why you can file your private court case in the court buildings. Because the judicial power includes the power of the clerk to work for your court. Yeah. Oh, okay. So, getting back to your question, what I would do is, in the early stages... if I got a 90-day letter from the IRS, if I got a 90-day letter from the IRS saying that I have an option to go to the tax court, I would take it and run with it. Okay? Why? Because if you look at Title 26, there's a specific section, which I cite on the website, which says that the tax court is a court of record. That means we're proceeding according to the common law procedure, That means I'm the petitioner or plaintiff. That means I own the court. The magistrates cannot make any decisions. Okay? And the government is the defendant, the respondent in a tax court. So that's where I would take it. And some people have done that. Some have been successful, some have not. Mainly because of what they knew or didn't know. So that's my answer to your question. You want your computer back?
No.
Okay.
I'm taking it back to me.
Okay.
Close it, I'll shut it down.
Yeah, we're leaving in 5 minutes anyway. Okay.
Good night, all.
All right. Night. So, you see, the Court of Records is a very powerful concept, and it's got the backing of the United States Supreme Court. They didn't create it. They simply acknowledged it in their decisions. Okay?
I have one other question. Is this Supreme Court you're talking about the Article III Supreme Court or the Supreme Court of the District of Columbia?
I don't think my opposition knows the difference.
You know the difference.
I don't care, because I'm above them. My court of record is above their court. It's a court of the people. Look, you have, and look at the power, the way it flows. We the people created the Constitution, created this for them. Now the power stuff comes from the people and goes down, flows downhill to these people. Okay? Now, part of that flow goes through the Supreme Court of the United States, right? So they are subject to my sovereign authority. That's why it's not appealable. Okay? They can't buck the sovereignty of the country. The United States government has no sovereignty of its own. The Supreme Court has acknowledged that. I say acknowledged because it wasn't their decision, you see. But they acknowledged it. So the Supreme Court of the United States is nothing more than another agency from the point of view of the people. And they have no power to override the people. The only way that they can get any semblance of authority over you is to have one of the people come against you because you injured one of the people. Okay, does that make sense, all of it?
So then in the case of the bank and the bank representative, the lawyer, is that a person coming after you? But they're really not, they weren't involved at the time.
The lawyer is representing his client. It's the client you go after, unless you can show some violation of the rules that he's going by.
The client's never there.
Well, that may be, but he's representing the client. You could insist on testimony in your court from the client if he has a case. If you want to take it to trial, but why take it to trial? Once
that's defining personal knowledge versus hearsay, which is the attorney is hearsay.
Sure.
Because it's secondary information to him.
Yeah, you can shut down the attorney because he doesn't have personal knowledge anyway. You know, you say, I object. Why do you object? Well, it's personal. He doesn't have personal knowledge. It's hearsay. Yes, sir.
Yeah, and so in this case, court of record that you're doing, there's no way anybody could force you to have an attorney, a public defender, because you know, you're in charge of the whole thing, correct?
Well, you're mixing your courts. You're talking about what they do in the government courts, and then you're saying there's no way they could force your private court to do the government thing. You don't have a public defender in a court that you own.
Right, that's what I thought.
Yeah, it doesn't. It's a foreign concept to your court.
Right. Just wanted to clarify.
Okay. I think Bob has told me that I'm in trouble if I speak anymore.
You got 1 minute.
I got 1 minute. Well, let me say this: that what we've talked about here just scratched the surface. The title implied more than what we really got. I really need to talk to you for about maybe 10 hours. In order to cover the range of topics that it involved in court procedure. But you'll be way ahead. I told you the two most critical things, which is that first sentence, that sets the platform on which everything else stands. And then you include the law of the case, and you have an example of this. If you go to 1215.org/Q, you have an example of the various things, the writs of error, the contempts, the bench warrant if necessary. And in 30 years, the bench warrant, I've only had to do once. In all that time, I've only had to issue one contempt of court, which I fined $1. I mean, one for the judge. What I found out is about 5% of the judges, I have to go a second writ of error, followed up by a contempt fine for $1. Okay? And they get the point. They understand where you're coming from. Because, why? Because that writ of error and that contempt contain a complete explanation as to why the judge cannot make a decision. It also does one more thing. And that is that the judge is sitting there, he's getting paid. And the people that are paying him, his bosses, want him to follow certain policies. So, if he doesn't follow those policies, his job will be in jeopardy, won't it? Okay, so because I have surrounded him with the common law and prevented him from acting, he can then tell his superiors that he was limited by virtue of the fact that the law stopped him, that I had him cornered. Now he's immune from their punishment. See? So that's why the judge can relax, because he knows not only did I stop him, but I also protected him. And he, if you are being reasonable, if you're not going off the deep end and all this patriot crap, you know, and you just simply look like what a typical attorney would write with, and you make good solid points, then you don't incur that animosity from the judge. It's just business. And if you, when you go on the website, there's a case there where this guy got on a bicycle, got hit by a car that did not yield the right of way. And in that case, we have the transcripts where we actually convicted the judge of contempt of court and fined him. And you will see how friendly he was, because he knew we were genuine. You see? He didn't get mad at us. He realized, okay, we're on track. But he had to challenge us. No question about it. He had to, because that's his job requirement. That's the power structure's requirement. But once we made it clear and we locked him in, the show was over as far as that was concerned. Now he was safe and having fun and enjoying it. You see?
Is your current phone number on the website?
Yeah. But I don't review papers, and I do not write papers. But I answer questions, and I don't charge for answering questions. If you got a question,
phone number then.
It's 714-604-8654. Subject to change. Every time I lose a phone. Okay. All right. So, good
Bill,
luck.
Let's give Bill a hand here. This is most
thank you.
Terrific tonight. As he says, that's just probably just scratching the surface of the things that we as lay people don't understand. The common man. And it's always wonderful to have Bill communicate to us and something that we always learn from
Bob.
Him with.
How can you say that?
It's while easy. I practice it every night, but I know you're going to talk.
While I was talking, I lost 20% of my audience.
Well,
they left.
That's behind you now. Anyway, thank you again for
you're welcome
for this presentation tonight. And
okay,
as far as next month is concerned, I've got a conflict here that maybe I have to resolve. But I want to thank you all for being here, and I hope you got something out of it that was beneficial to each of us. I know I got some things, and I have some questions I have to raise, but that's on a private basis. So, again, thank you, Bill.
You're
thank
welcome.
You all for being here.
Happy
and
to be
the
here.
Meeting is adjourned.
Amen.